Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about the similarities between rock music and the U.S. economy. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 7, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
President Obama's economic advisor, Alan Krueger, has studied the ways technology has transformed another key industry. Mr. Krueger, who will soon be leaving Washington, D.C. to return to his old job teaching economics at Princeton, took some ribbing from his boss this week.
And now that Alan has some free time, he can return to another burning passion of his, rockonomics. The economics of rock and roll. This is something that Alan actually cares about.
In fact, Mr. Krueger gave a speech this week at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where he said, the music business offers valuable lessons about the broader U.S. economy, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Krueger titled his speech, Land of Hope and Dreams, in honor of his fellow New Jersey native, Bruce Springsteen. Springsteen boasted the second highest grossing concert tour last year, right behind Madonna, with 72 shows that together raked in more than $199 million. That makes The Boss a fitting emblem of our modern superstar economy. In music, as in so many industries, Krueger says, the lion's share of the money now goes to a relative handful of top performers.
The lucky and the talented, and it is often hard to tell the difference, have been doing better and better, while the vast majority has struggled to keep up.
Economists point to a variety of explanations for that growing concentration of income, technology, globalization, and Krueger highlights that role of luck, noting that for every superstar, there are other equally talented performers who don't catch the same breaks. He notes that Columbia Records almost passed on the hit single that Rolling Stone later called the greatest rock and roll song ever. Lucky for us, Bob Dylan's six-minute opus was released, and thanks to modern recording technology, Dylan was able to reach a worldwide audience. More recently, of course, technology has upended the music business, depressing album sales so artists depend more on concerts to make money. Krueger says that's a big reason concert tickets have gotten more expensive. But as every good scalper knows, many artists still don't charge as much as they could for fear of breaking an implicit bargain with their fans.
Along these lines, Tom Petty once said, I don't see how carving out the best seats and charging a lot more for them has anything to do with rock and roll. And I won't
back down. Krueger says for much of the last century, the whole U.S. economy was governed by a similar social compact, the idea that economic gains should be widely shared. Krueger argues that was reinforced in the decades after World War II by a progressive tax system, labor unions, and a rising minimum wage.
Now, I'll argue that that social compact was good for business and it was good for the economy. But the social compact began to fray in the 1980s.
Since then, top earners have seen their incomes skyrocket, while the middle class has been treading water, and those at the bottom of the income ladder have actually fallen a few rungs. Not surprisingly, as an advisor in a Democratic White House, Krueger advocates policies designed to mitigate that trend. He says a stronger middle class would not only fuel more economic growth, but also promote more equal opportunity.
President Obama's economic advisor, Alan Krueger, has studied the ways technology has transformed another key industry. Mr. Krueger, who will soon be leaving Washington, D.C. to return to his old job teaching economics at Princeton, took some ribbing from his boss this week.
And now that Alan has some free time, he can return to another burning passion of his, rockonomics, the economics of rock and roll. This is something that Alan actually cares about.
In fact, Mr. Krueger gave a speech this week at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where he said the music business offers valuable lessons about the broader U.S. economy, and NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Krueger titled his speech Land of Hope and Dreams in honor of his fellow New Jersey native, Bruce Springsteen. Springsteen boasted the second highest grossing concert tour last year, right behind Madonna, with 72 shows that together raked in more than $199 million. That makes The Boss a fitting emblem of our modern superstar economy. In music, as in so many industries, Krueger says, the lion's share of the money now goes to a relative handful of top performers.
The lucky and the talented, and it is often hard to tell the difference, have been doing better and better, while the vast majority has struggled to keep up.
Economists point to a variety of explanations for that growing concentration of income, technology, globalization, and Krueger highlights that role of luck, noting that for every superstar, there are other equally talented performers who don't catch the same breaks. He notes that Columbia Records almost passed on the hit single that Rolling Stone later called the greatest rock and roll song ever. Like a rolling stone. Lucky for us, Bob Dylan's six-minute opus was released, and thanks to modern recording technology, Dylan was able to reach a worldwide audience. More recently, of course, technology has upended the music business, depressing album sales so artists depend more on concerts to make money. Krueger says that's a big reason concert tickets have gotten more expensive. But as every good scalper knows, many artists still don't charge as much as they could for fear of breaking an implicit bargain with their fans.
Along these lines, Tom Petty once said, "I don't see how carving out the best seats and charging a lot more for them has anything to do with rock and roll." And I won't
back down. Krueger says for much of the last century, the whole U.S. economy was governed by a similar social compact, the idea that economic gains should be widely shared. Krueger argues that was reinforced in the decades after World War II by a progressive tax system, labor unions, and a rising minimum wage.
Now, I'll argue that that social compact was good for business, and it was good for the economy. But the social compact began to fray in the 1980s.
Since then, top earners have seen their income skyrocket, while the middle class has been treading water, and those at the bottom of the income ladder have actually fallen a few rungs. Not surprisingly, as an advisor in a Democratic White House, Krueger advocates policies designed to mitigate that trend. He says a stronger middle class would not only fuel more economic growth, but also promote more equal opportunity.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a woman talking about her fascination with a game you can play on your smartphone. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
For 2 days last week, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to read or talk to people. I certainly didn't want to work. All I wanted to do was stare at little squiggles on a screen and guess which logos they represented. It all started when one of my sons shoved his iPhone under my nose and pointed at 2 excessively curly letters in a blue circle. "What's that?" he demanded. "General Electric," I replied in a flash. This was all it took. From that minute, I was a slave to Logos Quiz, a game that for the past couple of weeks has been the most downloaded free app for the iPhone. It starts off gently with images everyone knows, Starbucks, Facebook, and so on, but then gets harder, tantalising you with tiny parts of logos that you know, but can't quite place. There's the rush of joy on realising that a thin white line with a red surround is part of CNN. A further jolt of pleasure comes with seeing that the 2 black S's that have been eluding you are Hugo Boss. If you get stuck, you can ask for a clue or ask on Twitter. I used to wonder what this microblogging site was for. Now I know. It's to disturb as many people as possible and ask them if they can identify the red swan with the circle around it. I'm aware that I ought not to be pushing this electronic form of crack cocaine to Financial Times readers. If you download this thing, you can say goodbye to work for the rest of the day. But still, I urge you to do so. This is no paper toss or super rat the cheese addiction. It's essential for everyone who is even slightly interested in memory or in branding. The first thing you come to realise is how these logos are tattooed on your brain. There was a study done a few years ago showing that toddlers recognise the McDonald's arches before they know their own names. Another, more recent study showed that seeing the golden arches triggers neurological changes that increase our reading speed. It's not called fast food for nothing. I used to think that this was just a McDonald's effect, so was never terribly worried. I despised the soppy columnists who wrote articles about the pernicious brainwashing power of brands. But now I'm not so sure. Take a blue oblong with the corners cut off. Set it at an angle. I looked at this for about half a second before I found myself yelling "Blockbuster" at my iPad. How did that happen? I've never rented a Blockbuster video in my life, or knowingly walked past a store, or seen any advertising. What was the image doing, lurking there so easy to find when other things, the name of a neighbour or the plot of a novel I've read recently, have vanished altogether? Our stock of logos is so ingrained that they've become part of who we are. So much so that we're taken aback when people close to us don't have the same stock. My younger son was floored by the chunky red K on the yellow background, as he'd never heard of Kodak. For 2 days last week, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to read or talk to people. I certainly didn't want to work. All I wanted to do was stare at little squiggles on a screen and guess which logos they represented. It all started when one of my sons shoved his iPhone under my nose and pointed at two excessively curly letters in a blue circle. "What's that?" he demanded. "General Electric," I replied in a flash. This was all it took. From that minute, I was a slave to Logos Quiz, a game that for the past couple of weeks has been the most downloaded free app for the iPhone. It starts off gently with images everyone knows, Starbucks, Facebook, and so on, but then gets harder, tantalising you with tiny parts of logos that you know but can't quite place. There's the rush of joy on realising that a thin white line with a red surround is part of CNN. A further jolt of pleasure comes with seeing that the two black S's that have been eluding you are Hugo Boss. If you get stuck, you can ask for a clue or ask on Twitter. I used to wonder what this microblogging site was for. Now I know. It's to disturb as many people as possible and ask them if they can identify the red swan with the circle around it. I'm aware that I ought not to be pushing this electronic form of crack cocaine to Financial Times readers. If you download this thing, you can say goodbye to work for the rest of the day. But still, I urge you to do so. This is no paper toss or super rat the cheese addiction. It's essential for everyone who is even slightly interested in memory or in branding. The first thing you come to realise is how these logos are tattooed on your brain. There was a study done a few years ago showing that toddlers recognise the McDonald's arches before they know their own names. Another, more recent study showed that seeing the golden arches triggers neurological changes that increase our reading speed. It's not called fast food for nothing. I used to think that this was just a McDonald's effect, so was never terribly worried. I despised the soppy columnists who wrote articles about the pernicious brainwashing power of brands. But now I'm not so sure. Take a blue oblong with the corners cut off. Set it at an angle. I looked at this for about half a second before I found myself yelling "Blockbuster" at my iPad. How did that happen? I've never rented a Blockbuster video in my life, or knowingly walked past a store, or seen any advertising. What was the image doing, lurking there so easy to find when other things, the name of a neighbour or the plot of a novel I've read recently, have vanished altogether? Our stock of logos is so ingrained that they've become part of who we are. So much so that we're taken aback when people close to us don't have the same stock. My younger son was floored by the chunky red K on the yellow background, as he'd never heard of Kodak.
Task 3. You are going to listen to an interview with Blaine Leonard on the state of American traffic and sewage systems. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
After that I-35 bridge collapse in 2007, it was reported that more than 73,000 bridges around the country were rated structurally deficient by the Federal Highway Administration, and another 80,000 rated functionally obsolete. Well, this week, we heard President Obama propose $50 billion in infrastructure spending to rebuild roads, bridges, and runways, and construct new rail lines.
I am announcing a new plan for rebuilding and modernizing America's roads and rails and runways for the long term. I want America to have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
We're going to get a report card now on the country's infrastructure from Blaine Leonard. He's president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
And if that bridge collapse in 2007 was a big wake-up call to the country, do you think that there's been significant progress made since then?
No, unfortunately, really not. It was a wake-up call. Some people started talking about doing some things, but the fact of the matter is the infrastructure condition continues to decline. Our report card grades the nation's infrastructure at a D, and despite all of the talk that followed the I-35 collapse, we haven't done anything significant to reverse that trend.
Well, you mentioned spending, and of course, part of the stimulus package passed last year was money for infrastructure, maybe $100 billion or so. I feel like as I drive around, I see road signs indicating that the construction project underway is because of the Stimulus Act. How is that money being spent?
The stimulus package was about $787 billion. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about $70 to $100 billion actually went into tangible physical infrastructure. Now, $70 billion is a lot of money, but when you compare that against the shortfall that we have in transportation alone of $550 billion, it helps, but it doesn't get us there. Now, one of the challenges with the stimulus package was a significant portion of that money had to be spent very quickly. And so it quite often didn't go into large projects that take a lot of time to develop and get approved and get bid out. It went for a lot of routine maintenance things, pavement maintenance, for instance. And that was helpful. But it doesn't replace over 100,000 bridges that are structurally deficient or functional obsolete.
One other thing that the White House is proposing, along with this funding for infrastructure, is an infrastructure bank that would combine government spending with private financing. What do you think about that idea?
We applaud that idea. We really have to be creative in figuring out a new way to provide a steady, consistent source of funding for our infrastructure. In the 1960s, we were spending 5% of our gross domestic product on infrastructure. By the 90s, it was 2.5%. Today, it's less than 2%. We need to find better sources of funding and consistent funding.
That earlier period that you're talking about, where there was so much more spending on infrastructure, of course, that was when the highway system was being developed, when there was a whole lot of new building going on, and we're in a different phase now, right?
You're correct. In the 1950s through the 70s, we built an expansive interstate highway system. In the 70s, we built water and sewer treatment. In the late 70s, we built mass transit. And we built an infrastructure that was the envy of all the world. Unfortunately, we then sort of patted ourselves on the back and moved on to some other priorities and enjoyed the value of this great infrastructure. And what we built in the 50s through the 70s is now 30 to 50 years old. And most of it has fallen into disrepair. It's just old and needs to be renovated and replaced. It's time for us to sort of pick up that ball and run with it again.
After that I-35 bridge collapse in 2007, it was reported that more than 73,000 bridges around the country were rated structurally deficient by the Federal Highway Administration, and another 80,000 rated functionally obsolete. Well, this week, we heard President Obama propose $50 billion in infrastructure spending to rebuild roads, bridges, and runways, and construct new rail lines.
I am announcing a new plan for rebuilding and modernizing America's roads and rails and runways for the long term. I want America to have have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
We're going to get a report card now on the country's infrastructure from Blaine Leonard. He's president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
And if that bridge collapse in 2007 was a big wake-up call to the country, do you think that there's been significant progress made since then?
No, unfortunately, really not. It was a wake-up call. Some people started talking about doing some things, but the fact of the matter is the infrastructure condition continues to decline. Our report card grades the nation's infrastructure at a D, and despite all of the talk that followed the I-35 collapse, we haven't done anything significant to reverse that trend.
Well, you mentioned spending, and of course, part of the stimulus package passed last year was money for infrastructure, maybe $100 billion or so. I feel like as I drive around, I see road signs indicating that the construction project underway is because of the Stimulus Act. How is that money being spent?
The stimulus package was about $787 billion. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about $70 to $100 billion actually went into tangible physical infrastructure. Now, $70 billion is a lot of money, but when you compare that against the shortfall that we have in transportation alone of $550 billion, it helps. But it doesn't get us there. Now, one of the challenges with the stimulus package was a significant portion of that money had to be spent very quickly. And so it quite often didn't go into large projects that take a lot of time to develop and get approved and get bid out. It went for a lot of routine maintenance things, pavement maintenance, for instance. And that was helpful. But it doesn't replace over 100,000 bridges that are structurally deficient or functional obsolete.
One other thing that the White House is proposing, along with this funding for infrastructure, is an infrastructure bank that would combine government spending with private financing. What do you think about that idea?
We applaud that idea. We really have to be creative in figuring out a new way to provide a steady, consistent source of funding for our infrastructure. In the 1960s, we were spending 5% of our gross domestic product on infrastructure. By the 90s, it was 2.5%. Today, it's less than 2%. We need to find better sources of funding and consistent funding.
That earlier period that you're talking about, where there was so much more spending on infrastructure, of course, that was when the highway system was being developed, when there was a whole lot of new building going on, and we're in a different phase now, right?
You're correct. In the 1950s through the 70s, we built an expansive interstate highway system. In the 70s, we built water and sewer treatment. In the late 70s, we built mass transit. And we built an infrastructure that was the envy of all the world. Unfortunately, we then sort of patted ourselves on the back and moved on to some other priorities and enjoyed the value of this great infrastructure. And what we built in the 50s through the 70s is now 30 to 50 years old. And most of it has fallen into disrepair. It's just old and needs to be renovated and replaced. It's time for us to sort of pick up that ball and run with it again.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a report on how animals can help humans. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 9, with the sentence endings, A to L. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
So, antibiotics may not always be good for your health. Owning a pet can be. Research suggests that your interaction with a pet can help you live longer, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
So this is the Children's Inn. Welcome.
Meredith Daly works at the Children's Inn on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. It houses the families of children who are undergoing experimental therapies. The idea is to make the inn feel like an actual home, and one of the ways they do that is by having a resident dog. Meet Viola, or Vi for short.
She's giving you kisses.
Tonight, Vi is acting as the canine chaperone for about half a dozen kids and parents in the inn's learning center. There's a lesson going on at the work table, but 4-year-old Thelma Balmaceda is much more interested in Vi, who's sprawled on her back on the floor, wanting a belly rub.
You like the dog?
Yeah, I have a dog in my house.
What's your dog's name?
Yeah.
Vi, who's a retired seeing eye dog, has been a tremendous addition to the staff, says Daly. But Vi may well be doing more than just bringing smiles to the faces of stressed out parents and children. Aubrey Fine says dogs like Vi have helped launch an entirely new field of medical research over the past 3 decades or so. He's a child psychologist and professor at Cal State Polytech University in Pomona, California.
An animal's presence can reduce a person's stress level.
Fine uses a variety of animals, including dogs, birds, and even a lizard in his own practice. While he says animals have been used to help patients dating back to the 1800s, it's only in the past few decades that scientists have been able to pinpoint how exactly they help. For example, one of the first studies found that petting a dog can help reduce blood pressure in people with heart disease. And now several universities have centers that study human-animal relationships. Rebecca Johnson is a nurse who heads the one at the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine.
The research evidence on the benefits of human-animal interaction for people is very compelling now.
She says one of the most important discoveries has been that interacting with an animal increases a person's level of the hormone oxytocin. That's good because oxytocin helps people feel happy and trusting, but that's not all.
Oxytocin has some powerful effects for us in promoting the body's ability to be in a state of readiness to heal and also to grow new cells. So it predisposes us to an environment in our own bodies where we can be healthier.
So being around animals clearly has health benefits, but animals can also act as therapists themselves.
Okay, Ryan, let's go. Ready? Up, down.
9-year-old Ryan Shank Rowe has autism. Today, he's working with a special therapist, a large speckled gray pony named Happy, at the Northern Virginia Therapeutic Riding Program.
Happy has stopped, and we need her to
walk
go.
On.
Beautiful.
Kathy Coleman is Ryan's speech therapist. She used to see Ryan in an office, but as she jogs alongside Happy, Coleman says the horseback riding actually helps Ryan talk more.
I get greater engagement, greater alertness, more language, more processing, all those things.
And Ryan's mother, Donna Shank, says riding has helped with more than just speech.
It's helped his following directions, some really core life skills about, you know, getting dressed and balance, which really translates to a lot of safety issues, too.
Keep it going, buddy. Keep it going.
But sometimes it's not just people who benefit. Rebecca Johnson says some of the research is focused on the other end of the leash.
We want to know how the animals are benefiting from the exchange.
For example, Johnson has studied volunteers who walk dogs at animal shelters. Those programs have clearly helped people get healthier, she says, but they've helped the dogs at the same time.
They were significantly more likely to be adopted if they were in the dog walking group.
Johnson's now working on a new project with likely benefits for dogs and humans. Military veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are providing shelter dogs with basic obedience training. And while it's still early in the research, she says, one thing seems pretty clear.
Helping the animals is helping the veterans to readjust to being at home.
Now the field is about to get another big scientific boost. The National Institutes of Health recently established the first ever program to fund human-animal interaction research.
So, antibiotics may not always be good for your health. Owning a pet can be. Research suggests that your interaction with a pet can help you live longer, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
So this is the Children's Inn. Welcome.
Meredith Daly works at the Children's Inn on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. It houses the families of children who are undergoing experimental therapies. The idea is to make the inn feel like an actual home, and one of the ways they do that is by having a resident dog. Meet Viola, or Vi for short.
She's giving you kisses.
Tonight, Vi is acting as the canine chaperone for about half a dozen kids and parents in the inn's learning center. There's a lesson going on at the work table, but 4-year-old Thelma Balmaceda is much more interested in Vi, who's sprawled on her back on the floor, wanting a belly rub.
You like the dog?
Yeah, I have a dog in my house.
What's your dog's name?
Yeah.
Vi, who's a retired seeing eye dog, has been a tremendous addition to the staff, says Daly. But Vi may well be doing more than just bringing smiles to the faces of stressed out parents and children. Aubrey Fine says dogs like Vi have helped launch an entirely new field of medical research over the past 3 decades or so. He's a child psychologist and professor at Cal State Polytech University in Pomona, California.
An animal's presence can reduce a person's stress level.
Fine uses a variety of animals, including dogs, birds, and even a lizard in his own practice. While he says animals have been used to help patients dating back to the 1800s, it's only in the past few decades that scientists have been able to pinpoint how exactly they help. For example, one of the first studies found that petting a dog can help reduce blood pressure in people with heart disease. And now several universities have centers that study human-animal relationships. Rebecca Johnson is a nurse who heads the one at the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine.
The research evidence on the benefits of human-animal interaction for people is very compelling now.
She says one of the most important discoveries has been that interacting with an animal increases a person's level of the hormone oxytocin. That's good because oxytocin helps people feel happy and trusting, but that's not all.
Oxytocin has some powerful effects for us in promoting the body's ability to be in a state of readiness to heal and also to grow new cells. So it predisposes us to an environment in our own bodies where we can be healthier.
So being around animals clearly has health benefits, but animals can also act as therapists themselves.
Okay, Ryan, let's go. Ready? Up, down.
9-year-old Ryan Shank Rowe has autism. Today, he's working with a special therapist, a large speckled gray pony named Happy, at the Northern Virginia Therapeutic Riding Program.
Happy has stopped, and we need her to
walk on.
Beautiful.
Kathy Coleman is Ryan's speech therapist. She used to see Ryan in an office, but as she jogs alongside Happy, Coleman says the horseback riding actually helps Ryan talk more.
I get greater engagement, greater alertness, more language, more processing, all those things.
And Ryan's mother, Donna Shank, says riding has helped with more than just speech.
It's helped his following directions, some really core life skills about, you know, getting dressed and balance, which really translates to a lot of safety issues, too.
Keep it going, buddy. Keep it going.
But sometimes it's not just people who benefit. Rebecca Johnson says some of the research is focused on the other end of the leash.
We want to know how the animals are benefiting from the exchange.
For example, Johnson has studied volunteers who walk dogs at animal shelters. Those programs have clearly helped people get healthier, she says, but they've helped the dogs at the same time.
They were significantly more likely to be adopted if they were in the dog walking group.
Johnson's now working on a new project with likely benefits for dogs and humans. Military veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are providing shelter dogs with basic obedience training. And while it's still early in the research, she says, one thing seems pretty clear.
Helping the animals is helping the veterans to readjust to being at home.
Now the field is about to get another big scientific boost. The National Institutes of Health recently established the first ever program to fund human-animal interaction research.
This is the end of the listening test.